Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our deputy editor, Matt Matem.
Hello.
And our online editor, Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
And this week we have a bumper pod. Are you ready for this? We are talking to Ridley Scott about his illustrious career and his new project, House of Gucci. We'll also be rating House of Gucci, Encanto, A Boy Called Christmas, Pirates, Lapwing, and JFK Revisited Through the Looking Glass. That's quite a lot to get through. But before we do get to those, what have you guys been watching? Jack, what have you been feasting your eyes on?
Well, today Hawkeye came out.
Yeah.
The new Marvel series. So I watched the first two episodes in advance. That was interesting. I mean, it's been a very Marvel-filled year, hasn't it?
We've had
quite a few Disney Plus shows, movies, all that. And so Hawkeye's like Christmas-based. It's a bit of fun. It's like, doesn't take itself too seriously. Introduces Hayley Steinfeld's new character, Kate Bishop, who's kind of in line to take over the Hawkeye name. It's interesting because it's kind of like a double header between the two. It's more, the first two episodes are much more her than Jeremy Renner's Hawkeye, which is surprising, but interesting as well. So yeah, if you're a Marvel fan, you'll probably get on with it quite well. I mean, it's the first time this Avengers had a solo thing going on.
And for my money, I don't think I need that in my life.
You know what? He's really good in it. I'm really drawn to him for some reason in this show. Like, I've never been before, but
yeah. They
make him really, really likable.
Yeah. Well, there we are. It's done its work. Matt, what have you been watching? Have you also been Hawkeyeing it?
I haven't seen Hawkeye yet, but I will be watching it, not least because of the Christmas setting. It sort of has to be watched.
Oh,
now,
yes, you are
it?
A Christmas nerd.
Between now and Christmas, yeah. So definitely will watch that. And of course, I watched the Great British Bake Off final last night.
Ah.
Have you watched it, Jack, or not?
Yeah, I watched it. The twists and turns of that episode.
I was very happy that Giuseppe won. What about you?
Oh, yeah, over the moon. Over the moon for Giuseppe. I mean, I would have liked a Jürgen Giuseppe finale. You know, the two Europeans going up against it. But no, great episode.
And it was actually one of those finals where I liked all the contestants in the final. But Giuseppe was my favourite. And I didn't think he was going to win. So when it kind of, you know, came to at the end, that was a moment of triumph. So yeah, that was good.
I've got a soggy bottom.
I've had to watch a couple of Christmas films to sort of review, including one called Fat Man, which stars Mel Gibson as this really kind of gritty, realistic Father Christmas figure called Kris Kringle. And he's kind of based in Alaska making presents and stuff, but it's very kind of gritty and real world. And I mean, in a kind of black comedy way. And the film basically revolves around this bratty rich kid who gets a lump of coal in his stocking. So then he hires a hitman played by Walton Goggins to go and assassinate Kris Kringle. And
Extreme. That's
where the film goes from there. So it's not great by any stretch, but I did appreciate it for being so kind of doing something so different to your standard Christmas film. So it had that going for it.
Cool. Okay, well, we have, as we said, a lot to get through, not least a lovely chat with Ridley Scott. So let's get started, shall we? I probably should do this. Allora, in my Italian accent, it's this.
Gucci. It was a name that sounded so sweet, so seductive.
Come, meet the family.
Hey, everybody, this is Patrizia.
And this is my family.
Kick this teeth out!
They had it all. Wealth, style, power. Who wouldn't care for that?
So that is, of course, House of Gucci, Ridley Scott's second release this year. And it charts the turbulent marriage of Maurizio Gucci to Patrizia Reggiani, the scion of a fashion house and a woman who wouldn't be ignored. Before we get into whether this is bellissimo or brutto, let's listen to what Ridley Scott had to say when Jack sat down with him to discuss this film and a few other corkers in his career. What was he like? I mean, he's been making headlines for saying all sorts of stuff at the moment. Is he a cranky old man?
I wouldn't say cranky. He's a lot of fun. I mean, I love Ridley Scott. I think he's just a fantastic filmmaker, obviously. And, you know, he's kind of at that stage in his life where he just doesn't give a fig. Yeah, he's slightly unfiltered. I mean, even just talking about House of Gucci and stuff was really interesting, getting into, you know, the casting choices and talking about Lady Gaga and even the Gucci family's reaction to the movie. You know, there's a part where he's talking about Al Pacino and how they should feel grateful having this brilliant actor playing them. But then when we talk about movies in the chat, you'll notice that we don't quite talk about some of the bigger ones, but I touch on like his unmade version of Dune. And also a movie called 1492 Conquest of Paradise, which I should probably set up because I doubt anyone's seen it.
But I have.
What do you think?
It's fine. It's fine. Yeah. I don't hate it.
It's like his first historical epic. So it's got quite a big place like in his filmography, but it's not often spoken about. It's got Gerard Depardieu playing Christopher Columbus. And when I asked him about it, I kind of just mentioned the name of the film. And then he just kind of goes off on one about how it wasn't well received and stuff like that. So the interview is slightly in companion to the current interview in the current magazine of Total Film, where Jordan spoke to him. So hopefully if you've read that, then this will bolster your thoughts on Ridley Scott.
Let's get into it. Let's have a listen to what Ridley has to say.
I've been reading that you're famously quite meticulously prepared for your shoots. So I'm wondering, with such a celebrated cast as this, like how much room do you give them to play in a scene when you're shooting?
I'm a very good caster, I've discovered. I'm pretty good at casting. It's very important to cast properly because if I cast really well, then half the pressure is off me on the day. So I can then concentrate on the overall scheme of things, and a great actor will help me as a partner. They will bring their own things to bear to it, because I don't believe in the Svengali process, except when you've got a difficult child. So I make sure I cast as best I can. So when I do that, you know, they're so sophisticated at this level. You got to remember, an actor does it 4 times a year or 3 times a year. I get to do it even as a speedy director, very faster. I do it once a year. They're so far ahead of me on the racetrack. When I hit the ground running, I haven't been really talking to actors for nearly a year, and they've been talking to directors, good, bad, or indifferent, constantly throughout the year. So it's a funny mixture of when I arrive and making myself known to them, what I do, how I do it, what I expect and how I voice myself. And what I try to do is make, as soon as possible, a partnership. It's a partnership. It's not director-actor. And that's why if I'm meeting them beforehand, which normally I do, I'm really trying to create a friendship, because once you're into that situation of working in front of a big unit, and I'm asking a person to literally reveal themselves to this group of people, they got to feel safe. And so from my point of view, I try to make the arena that they're about to enter safe, so they feel very well looked after. And then I find they open up and blossom.
I mean, talking about casting, obviously one of the big talking points here has been Lady Gaga as Patricia. You know, she said that she was in character for 18 months. I mean, it feels like she committed to the role in a way that almost feels like someone trying to prove themselves as, you know, like a singer turned actor. So I'm wondering kind of like, what do you think has made her so successful in the role?
I think Lady Gaga is in competition with herself. She drives her own engine in a funny kind of way that also denominates her as an artist. She's a real artist, both as a singer and a producer of her huge shows that she does in Las Vegas. Shows are enormous. That's part of her thing. She knows what she has to do. She knows she has to be prepared. Preparation is all about detail. Then once you're detailed, you can then relax and it can appear to be not detailed or not overworked. An actor once said to me, very, very good actor once, I said, you know, what's the worst thing about your job? And he said, he's Welsh. He said, well, you know, boy, the worst thing is I have to learn my lines, which is the fuck murder. He said, but the worst thing about it is I have to learn everyone else's lines so I can pretend I don't know what's coming, which I thought was a very good way of putting it.
What was it about this story in particular that you really wanted to kind of grab onto and needed to tell it? And then kind of like what clicked into place at this point in time for it to finally happen?
Well, the bottom line is, I think it feels like a 15th century story told in the 21st century, because it's not far off that Medici or the Borgias' digression into their one difficulty leading to tragedy after another. I think this story was found by my wife, who's a producer. This would be her fifth movie. She started to develop it from the book, which historically was pretty accurate, we think, as far as we know. But a book is not a screenplay. So then you have to have the screenplay adaptation. So in the adaptation, you have to take certain liberties on time and space, because a lot of the stories actually stretch out between her divorce and his demise was 6 years. In that 6 years, there was a lot of relentless pursuit by her of him. I don't know how he didn't get some kind of injunction to stop her bothering him. So you've got to play with time and space to make the story work. Because as the film stands right now, it's, you know, roughly 2.5 hours, which is longish for any film today. But I think it holds up in its evolution very well.
Definitely. And I think talking about the book it's based on, and do you feel that a story like this is anyone's to tell? Is, even though that, you know, the people in it are still alive, but perhaps not quite consenting to the story being told?
For sure, there is that to it, certainly. I tried to be as respectful as possible by being as factual as possible, and as factual as we can possibly imagine. So time and space sometimes has to jump because of the nature of the length of the film. The people that were writing from the family to us at the onset were kind of alarmingly insulting, saying that Al Pacino did not represent physically Aldo Gucci in any shape or form, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, frankly, how could they best be better represented than by Al Pacino? Saying, excuse me? You're probably one of the best actors in the world. They should be so fucking lucky. And I tried to find a way of saying, in a funny kind of way, it's a satire. And therefore, a satire is really a posh way of saying it's a comedy. And I think a lot of it is comedic, certainly for the first two acts. Jared Leto, there's not a lot of information about Paolo, but there's pictures of Paolo, and that's exactly what Paolo looked like. We found the pictures, and Jared did what he did and dressed the way Paolo dressed. There's not a lot of Paolo on camera talking, if anything. And so that had to be, to a certain extent, imagined. But clearly, Paolo was a very colorful and flamboyant man who was married to a woman who's a very good opera singer. Mm. So the lady portraying Paolo's wife in this film is really great in voice. That's her singing. Wow. So the flamboyance of Paolo, I think, was quite nicely captured. And how could that be offensive? So we paid attention to not getting too overt if we can avoid it.
I think Jared Leto is a scene stealer in this. I think he's terrific, as they all are. Now, I kind of want to quickly take a small walk down memory lane. The first film of yours I'd like to talk about is The Duelist. You know, it's the first film you made. When you reflect on your experience with that, do you think more about the kind of production of the movie, getting it made, the making of it, or do you look back and you see the legacy that that movie has had?
By the time I was 27, I already started my own company in London. The company was flying at 27. It was called RSA. And I was doing television commercials at that point. I'd personally do 100 commercials a year myself. Wow. And so I was the first one to get into having a stable. I'm sure directors don't mind being called like thoroughbreds. A stable of directors. I was the first one to really get really key, very posh directors on board to work within the company. So it was like a healthy team within the company and competitive team. So it was a very creative company. Because it was so successful, I opened up in Paris and New York, then LA. By now I'm 38 and I haven't even noticed, I haven't done a film yet. And so I thought, my God, I better start making movies. So because we've been making money, I was able to start offsetting some of that against having screenplays written. And I had written two scripts by the same writer called Jerry Vaughan Hughes before I got going. He wrote the gunpowder plot for me, which is still fantastic and makeable and should be made today. So that's on the level of Man for All Seasons. And The Duelist was the one that appealed to me because it felt like a Western and about the mindlessness behind violence where you can't even remember what the original argument was about. And that was a great bottom line on what The Duelist was. Doing it, honestly, I was so practiced. When you're doing 100 commercials a year, and I'm also probably one of the best camera operators in the business because I do that, I'm a camera operator as well. So I operated on The Duelist, Alien. I wasn't allowed to operate on Blade Runner, but then back to London. And when I'm in London, I'm operating on camera. So I'm so versed as a filmmaker. Doing The Duelist, I thought, Jesus, that was easy. Next, you know what I'm saying? We did that in 8.5 weeks in pouring rain in the Dordogne. David Putnam, who was my producer at the time, said, listen, they want to do it for a British entry at Cannes. Are you up for that? I said, absolutely. So we were suddenly the British entry at Cannes. That was the first film. And we won. We won the Grand Jury Prize at Cannes for what they call the Golden Egg. In French, it sounds better, but it's actually the Golden Egg.
Obviously, you went from that into, you know, Alien. Between Alien and Blade Runner, you know, I was reading about your production on Dune and your work on Dune. And I was wondering, the end result of David Lynch's version, it was what it was. And now we have Denis Villeneuve's very accomplished take on it. There's one acclaim everywhere. I'm wondering, you know, do you feel that the tech has finally caught up with that story? Or do you think it's always been filmable?
Oh, it's always been filmable. I had a writer called Rudy Wurlitzer of the Wurlitzer family. You know the jukebox?
Yes.
He'd written two films, Two Lane Blacktop with James Taylor and Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, in which he had Bob Dylan, Chris Christopherson. We did a very good take on Dune. In early days, I'd work very, very, very closely with the writer. And so I was always glomming the look of the film onto what he's writing, or he or she's writing. And then Dino had got me into it and said, it's expensive, we're going to have to make it in Mexico. I went, what? Mexico. I said, really? So he sent me to Mexico City, and I went to the studio in Mexico City where the floors were earth in the studio. I said, nah, Dino, I don't want to make this a hardship. And so I actually backed out. Okay. Instead, moved on to Legend.
There was another movie that I found really interesting that I watched for the first time last night of yours, which is 1492, Conquest of Paradise.
Oh, it's Gerard is fantastic. And the fact, you know, his French accent, I don't think it got in the way at all because I understood exactly what he was doing. But the studio was going, oh, we can't understand. So, you know, do you have any problem understanding it? No.
No.
In America, they're in here. They're not used to different accents. So they don't hear shit unless it's from Texas or America, right? Or North South Carolina. So being in Europe, I think we are used to accents. And so Gerard's accent never bothered me at all. But honestly, that was an independent movie. It's independent. I raised $47 million for an independent movie. Are you kidding me? Out of Cannes, a friend at Paramount who bought the rights for the States for 10. Then I had to sit at Cannes and do what I'd never done since The Duelist. My experience at Cannes was not a good one on The Duelist, so I didn't want to go back. But I had to go to Cannes and sit there and pitch the movie. The production design was remarkable. Did you see a good print or a dodgy print?
I saw the Blu-ray.
It must look fantastic.
The visuals were holding up, definitely.
It's one of my favorite films because I watched it again thinking, what's interesting, they didn't know how to release it in America. But in Europe, I think it clocked $57 million in Europe. But that was then owned by Gaumont. Gaumont France released the movie.
Okay.
And, you know, I was going to say, if The Duelist had been made, when it was made, they made 7 prints. So I said to David, even though we won a prize at Cannes, so I said to Putnam, is this normal? He said, no, it's not normal. Clearly, they don't really want it. But had, you know, independent movie platforms, had they been going at that particular point, they'd have known what to do with The Duelist. And they'd have probably got Academy nominations or all that kind of thing. But because Paramount didn't know what to do with it, it kind of died in the sidelines. Yet it runs today as a 5-star, quote, masterpiece on Netflix.
We've been talking about these older films and stuff. And then more recently, you know, with Prometheus and Alien, Covenant, you've kind of been revisiting old classics and with, you know, Gladiator 2 kind of going back and kind of touching on an older work. I'm wondering, do you think now then you are becoming a more reflective filmmaker, or do you think it's still that you've still got the chase of wanting something new?
I've got no reflection in me whatsoever. It's entirely random and there is no plan. That's how you keep alive. I don't reflect. I hate awards because I turn them down because I say it's not over yet.
You've got box office success. You've got awards. You've got all this stuff. Does that stuff matter to you?
No. No, what matters is that I can continue doing what I'm doing. In a funny kind of way, I started off as the idea of becoming a painter, but, you know, a serious painter. And I always had a problem with it. I'd wrestle with painting at art school, a very good little art school in West Hartlepool, County Durham. I was there for 4 years. I started as general course of NDD, National Diploma in Design, but then inevitably touched on painting. Painting would have been for me if I could pull it off, but then I went to the Royal College and I watched David Hockney take off in his Formula One canvas, and there's no way I'm going to even attempt to do that. So in a funny kind of way, filming took the place of painting for me, because every painting is a brand new canvas and it's random.
Okay, so that was Ridley Scott and Jack chewing the fat. Shall we talk about his film now, House of Gucci? Set it up for us, Jack. You know, we did talk about what it is about, but go into a little bit more detail about who Al Pacino plays, and also we can't miss Jared Leto.
So Lady Gaga's Patricia Reggiani, we meet her as she's a receptionist for her father, but she quickly bumps into Adam Driver's Mario Gucci, and she borderline stalks him and kind of chases him down. And, you know, it all talks to her ambition, basically. You know, they fall in love, they get married, but soon, you know, it turns out that Maurizio is not on the best terms with his father, who's played by Jeremy Irons, or his uncle, who's played by Al Pacino. But eventually, Patricia pushes him back into the Gucci fold, which leads to a few difficult family interactions. But along the way, there's also Salma Hayek's soothsayer, who speaks to Lady Gaga's Patricia. And there's also Jared Leto's Paolo, who is a very over-the-top Gucci with his own ideas for where the brand should go. There's quite a lot going on. It's very high camp, big drama, lots of fun Italian accents. I mean, I really, really loved it. What did you guys think?
You know, it's not the greatest, but it's sort of one of those deliciously awful good films. I thoroughly enjoyed it. As you say, I mean, nobody's doing the same accent. I feel like Lady Gaga's going into sort of Russian. Jeremy Irons is barely bothering at all, but ups it a bit as soon as Jared Leto walks in the room and starts with his minestrone macaroni. Everything has a at the end of it, even chica. You know, like, this is crazy. These costumes are amazing. We go through the 80s and the costumes, and everyone's smoking, and there's great 80s tunes banging out. It's ridiculous. It sort of reminds me of the sort of Roger Moore era James Bonds, and I have no problem with that. Matt, did you like it?
I did, yeah. I didn't love it quite as much as you guys, but it was one of those films that I really enjoyed for the time it was on, and it's on for a long time as well. It's like 157 minutes or something, so it's like a long time in the cinema. And I suppose the one thing I will say is the film didn't kind of feel long, and I didn't get bored, but I got very hungry towards the end. So prepare yourself before you go in, either bring snacks or sort of, you know, load up before you go in. But yes, I enjoyed it. But then I knew nothing really about this story before. I was not knowledgeable about the story at all. And I didn't know. I knew there was kind of, you know, crime elements to it, but I didn't know what they were. I didn't know who was targeting who or anything like that. So I was very interested as it all unfolded. But I didn't really feel like it dug deeply at all into the characters. And I kind of enjoyed it at the time, and then came away thinking, oh, I just don't really feel I got under the skin of any of those characters, or really, you know, really understood any of their motivations. And I didn't have any kind of emotional connection to them. It was fun for me. It was like enjoyable,
yeah, same,
to watch everyone camping it up. And it was, everything was so big. And it was clearly like, you know, I've heard it be referred to as a car crash and things like that, but I don't think that's fair, because it's all clearly so intentional. Like, you know, that's they're clearly going for that.
Yeah, I mean, there's that scene where, like, they're having sex, and you hear this sort of intro to it, and it goes straight to sort of a wedding scene where you can hear this music, and you're like, is that George Michael's Faith? And yes, it is. And that's that is the tempo we're going for here. Like, I don't think any of this is actually meant seriously. It's super arch, isn't it?
That's how I felt. But anyway, yeah, so I enjoyed it on that level. And I must admit as well, I had concerns about Jared Leto going in just simply because sometimes I do think, right, you know, what's the point of, you know, making up someone just to look completely different to what they are? Is that really necessary? Yada, yada, yada. But I found him just so kind of fun in the film. And it was one of those times where obviously he's got this prosthetics on that makes him look older and bald and just completely different. And it was one of those things where there was a sort of like cognitive dissonance or whatever, where I just couldn't kind of make my brain believe it was him a lot of the time, because he just looked and sounded and acted so differently. Everything he says is funny, basically, this film. Every line that he comes out with is funny. So yeah, so I love that aspect of it. I really, really like Lady Gaga's performance. I feel like she's definitely getting nominated for this.
Oh,
definitely.
She goes all out, doesn't she? I mean, it's amazing.
And I enjoyed Adam Driver as well. I enjoyed pretty much everyone in it, really.
Adam Driver was perhaps, because he's like the straight man in it.
Mm.
And so he was perhaps the least electric screen presence. Like even Al Pacino, when he's on, he's being this very like giving uncle. And I thought there was going to be something more sinister there, but there's almost not. As a surface level film, I think that I had so much fun with it. And I did think it went past really quickly. I think where it falters slightly is when it needs to get to where it's going to towards the end, and it kind of drags a bit. And there's also a lot of like business meetings where they're kind of talking about, you know, where the money from the Gucci name's going to go and who's going to buy it and all this stuff. And I was like, don't really need all that. Just get on with it.
No, but do you not find it fascinating? I mean, this is Shakespearean in the level of backstabbing that goes on here. I mean, as you said, Matt, it's difficult to connect emotionally with any of them, apart from I sort of felt for Paolo a little bit, I think mostly because he'd amuse me the most. Mm-hmm. But they're all horrible people. And really, why would you care about any of them? Because they are completely ruthless in everything they do. And I really enjoyed that those board table sort of meetings were like as violent, but in a business sense, as any murder would be, that people were absolutely betraying each other via shares in Gucci. Mm. And I really like that aspect.
Yeah, it's interesting as well, because as I was leaving the screening of this, there was someone who I won't name, but basically they were saying they found it really nihilistic and they basically didn't like it for that reason, because everyone is so horrible. And so I can see why people would have that issue. And again, I think perhaps that's why I didn't kind of connect with it on a deeper level, but had a lot of fun while it was on.
But that's the same with, like, I mean, my favorite TV show at the moment, Succession. You don't like any of them, but it's just great drama.
And this does have echoes of that, doesn't it? This sort of family drama, and, you know, you can't trust any of them, and they're all out to better themselves, and they don't care who they stand on to get there.
And it is very witty as well, you know, like it's, again, another thing that's just clearly intentional about it is it's clearly intended to be funny in a lot of places, which I liked.
So let's talk about Lady Gaga. I'm just going to do this before we do it, which is me and my spoon on my cup. She is ridiculous, right? She's not even trying subtle or nuance, is she? She's at 110. She starts at 11 and doesn't dial it back at all. You said you think she's going to get an Oscar nomination. Do you think so, Jack?
Yeah, I do. She just goes, you know, goes all out in this. You know, she anchors the film, because there are a lot of characters and a lot of big performances in it. And to keep it all together, you know, is quite an accomplishment, really. And especially when I've only really seen Gaga in A Star Is Born before, where she was really, really great. And now she's kind of gone from a more subtle performance to this really big one where she's doing like House of Gucci, like
House with of her, Gucci,
with
and never, and never knowingly wearing less than like 10 bracelets and a million rings and a brooch and
a different hairstyle for every scene.
Like how many wigs? The wig game in this film, you know, I love a wig, and the wig game is exceptional here. Yeah, it's everything is too much, and that's sometimes what I want from a film. I feel like audiences might really, really enjoy this as a sort of a ridiculous delight. It's sort of like tiramisu. You know, you eat it and it might make you feel a little bit sick. It's a little bit rich. It's a bit too much, but God, you enjoyed it whilst you're having it after your dinner. So yeah, I think it's probably a winner. It's just what I'd want to go out and see on a Saturday.
Interestingly as well, it's one of those films that a fair few people have kind of asked me about, just as in like normal people in my life, which I find interesting because I...
Normal people in my life?
Yeah, as in
what echelon are you living on?
Oh, when I say normal people in my life, I mean not you weirdos, you know, who like, we obviously are obsessed with every film that comes out. So I know you guys will know about it, but I'm always intrigued as to like the people who don't kind of, you know, work in our business, just the films that are of interest to them. And I just notably have had a few people ask me about this. So it obviously is kind of attracting attention. So fingers crossed it will do a bit better than the last
few. Parents would like it, don't you think? It's like, it's not a film that's just for us nerds that like film. I think parents would actually enjoy this and be like, you know, who's that Lady Gaga lady? She's quite good.
Yeah, it's got quite a broad appeal in that way, I would say. Yeah, because it's sort of funny, but it's interesting. And there's, you know, the sort of, you know, the fact it's a real true story element is appealing as well, you know.
Great cars, great outfits.
Yeah.
You know, different locations. We're in St. Moritz, we're in Lake Como. It's like glamour. It's a real escape.
Yeah, and obviously the cast kind of crosses like generational boundaries as well, you know. So you've got Pacino and Jeremy Irons, and then obviously you've got Adam Driver and Lady Gaga and Jared Leto. So there's something for everyone.
Yeah. I also like that everybody has a scene that they do something ridiculous in. So, you know, I love the way Al Pacino signs a document furiously and tosses a pen. And then, you know, Adam Driver, you said he's a bit bland, but he does get to throw a plate off the most amazing Parma ham. Jared Leto, let's not say what he does to Jeremy Irons' scarf. You know, like, it's just, I feel like there's gifts waiting to happen here. And like, I think people will be going out like fancy dress at Halloween next year, dressed as, you know, Patrizia or as Pablo. It's corking. Honestly, the more I talk about it, the more I think about it. I really liked it. I think I might need to go see it again just to enjoy these moments. So are we recommending? Reviews have been iffy. Nobody's declaring it a masterpiece, but some people have said it's dreadful. Would you recommend people go and see that this weekend?
I mean, I would, definitely.
Yes, it's a lot of fun. I would say yes, go for fun.
Yeah, I think if you're in that mindset where you're not thinking like, oh, this is going to be kind of very straight drama, Oscar baity type thing, and it's actually just like a bit of fun, then you'll have a great time.
Indeed. Okay, so I think we're saying this is on the Bellissimo side of things, and we recommend it. This is House of Gucci, and it is in cinemas on Friday. Right, it's time to travel from Italy to Colombia now with this.
Many years ago, this candle blessed our family with a miracle. Our house, our casita, came to life with magic.
Hola, casita.
Floors! Drawers! Let's go! In time, every member of our family...
Cecilia, up top!
...was given their own magical gift.
I understand you.
I'm not super strong like Luisa.
The donkey's got out again.
On it!
Or effortlessly perfect like Señorita Perfecta Isabella.
But Mama, why am I the only one that didn't get a gift?
You're just as special as anyone else in this family.
You just healed my hand with an arepa con queso.
So this is Encanto. Matt, you love your animation. What's this one about?
Okay, so basically, yes, this film is about the family Madrigal, and they're this extended family that live in this huge sort of enchanted house in Colombia. And every kind of blood member of the Madrigal family has a gift, as they call it, which is basically a superpower. Like, one is super strong, one has power to grow plants, another kind of influences the weather with her moods, one can heal people with food, you know, all different kind of skills like that. And yeah, so everyone in the family has this power except for daughter Mirabel, who's the main character. And she's voiced by Stephanie Beatriz from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, who basically I knew it was her going in, but I would have literally had no idea that this was her from watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine. She sounds completely different in this film. But anyway, yeah, so she's just the one member of the family that doesn't have this skill. And so obviously, you know, she kind of feels a bit left out. Then the main story really starts when strange things start happening in the house, and these weird cracks start to appear, and the sort of enchanted candle that keeps all their powers going starts to fade. And then it's up to Mirabelle to basically investigate what's going on and what it might have to do with the disappearance of her mysterious Uncle Bruno, who they don't talk about anymore.
Don't talk about Bruno.
No. And that's as much you'd want to know before going in. And of course, as well, must mention that this is, by my account, the fourth musical film this year that features Lin-Manuel Miranda in some way. He's kind of written the songs here, and he also gets a story credit as well. And the songs are very, very good in this. I think he literally does have that kind of Midas touch at the moment, where anything he does turns out very well, and he sort of seems unstoppable. That, to me, was the best thing about this film, was the songs are amazing, really, I thought. But what about you, Jane? Did you like the film?
I did like it. I think it's very interesting to see a film that's a Disney film like this, and his animation and his family orientated, but then is actually about, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder and a house that basically is imbued with the emotions of a family and the fractures of a family. So it's actually really weirdly sort of deep. And it reminded me of Relic, the horror film that came out, the Australian one, which I know sounds weird, but it's very much in a similar theme. And from that point of view, as an adult, I really liked it. And I think kids will enjoy it on surface, but there's obviously a lot more that when they grow up and watch it again, they might be like, oh my God, I never realized that this was about trauma, which is basically what the whole film is about, and also about accepting your greatness, whatever that is, and also familial pressure as well. You know, that the abuela in this is, she just has such pressure on her children to be something that she wants them to be. And so I found it really interesting. And as you say, the songs are so sort of toe-tapping, and they're all in different tempos. And, you know, if you've ever been to Colombia, I haven't, but I know people who have, that the music in Colombia, they have just like so much different tempos and types of music. And it feels like all of that is crammed in here, and every song is different. It just feels completely fresh and exciting and new. So, yeah, it was something that I could imagine listening to in the car. On a journey, on a Christmas car journey, perhaps, and sort of tapping along to it. It's really good. And it looks beautiful. I mean, the animation in this is gorgeous. Mm. Also, I really wanted Maribel's skirt. So that's just a little, you know, shout out to Disney. If you are sending out the skirts that she wears, definitely I'll have one. Yeah, it's beautiful.
It sounds a bit like Colombian musical X-Men.
It is.
It's sort of like, yeah, so it's the love child of X-Men and Relic, but with music and lots of flowers and lots of donkeys. Mm. Yeah. Does that sell it to you, Jack?
It's an odd pitch. I mean, I'm not the biggest like Disney musical person, so I'm not sure if I'll go seeking out. Also, I do feel a tad Lin-Manuel Miranda'd out this year, you know, after In the Heights and Vivo. And I still have, like, I'm quite excited
for Tick, Tick, Boom as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm quite excited for that one, more so, I'd say, than this one. But I really like Andrew Garfield, so he sold me on that.
You need to for that film, I'd say. Anyway, are we recommending that you take your kids and go for a Colombian family outing to this one, Matt?
Well, this is a weird one for me, because I felt very, very similar to you in the overall. Personally, I actually just really, really enjoyed the film, thought so much about it was really nicely done, and I just enjoyed it. But I had a four-year-old with me, and to be fair, he only asked me a few times, has it finished yet, like throughout it. And
was it Jack?
He came away like, you know, sort of earwormed by a couple of the songs as well. But it's one of those things that I feel this is true of so many animated family films these days. It feels like it's more aimed at adults than children, that from the story perspective, because as you say, there's this backstory that's quite intense, really, if you actually try and get your head around it. And then obviously on the posters there's loads of these animals and stuff like that, and you know, we learn that one family member's gift is to communicate with animals, but they play a very small part of the film. They're kind of front and center on the posters, but they're not really in the film that much. And just me projecting what I knew, you know, he would like, I was kind of a bit disappointed there wasn't a bit more animal action in it. And it kind of all comes down, it all kind of hinges on emotions that I think children just will have no idea of or concept of. So, I mean, for them, thank God it's got the songs to kind of keep them invested, because there's not really any, like, you know, besides the songs, and there's some really great dancing in it as well, where like I kind of went to a presentation a while back where they showed how they sort of did that dance, where they basically had real dancers and sort of, you know, studied them and everything, because, you know, the animators obviously couldn't just do it themselves. And besides the song and dance numbers, there's not really huge sort of set pieces or anything like that. I didn't think it's all kind of about kind of solving a mystery and, you know, coming to terms with these emotions. Whereas, you know, something like Raya and the Last Dragon, as the sort of other Disney animation we had earlier this year, that obviously has big action set pieces in it throughout, you know, that kind of keep younger people entertained. Maybe I'm just out of touch with the kids, I don't know. Yeah. But I enjoyed it.
Was so. Not that unimpressed capybara enough for you, that just sort of wandered on and looked unimpressed periodically?
I wanted more of him.
More capybara. Okay, yeah. Notes for Disney, okay, capybara going forward.
But yes, very enjoyable nonetheless.
Okay, so that is Encanto, and it is out in cinemas now. Get your dancing shoes on and go along. Okay, so it's the season for this.
You may find this hard to believe, but long ago, nobody knew about Christmas. It started with a boy called Nicholas and a summons from the king.
I'm asking you to go to the very edges of our kingdom and bring back a spark of magic to give us hope.
I'm going to Elfhelm to find the elves, Mika, to bring some new hopes to the world.
Such a fool. Everyone knows there is no such thing as elves.
You ready, old friend?
Born ready.
So this is A Boy Called Christmas, which is based on the book by Matt Haig. Tell us who the boy called Christmas is, Matt.
I hadn't read the book before seeing this film, but the boy is Nicholas. That's his name, which gives you a clue perhaps of, you know, who he might grow into. And basically Nicholas, he lives, you know, in, where do they even live? They just live
somewhere snowy
and mountainous.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't think it is supposed to be the North Pole. And he lives with his father, played by Michelle Huseman from Game of Thrones. And basically, he's obsessed with this legend that his late mother kind of, you know, used to tell about a girl who visited a place where elves lived. When things kind of take a bad turn for his sort of local town, he basically goes on a voyage to try and find this magical elf town.
With a talking mouse.
With a talking mouse with him, and to basically see if he can kind of bring some hope back to his town where he lives, which is, you know, ruled over by Jim Broadbent, who's this kind of, you know, doddery old sort of leader of the town. Goes from there, really. And when he gets to this elf place, he finds, you know, everything's not quite as it seems there.
I mean, you can see where this is going to end up from a mile off, right?
Oh, yes, yeah.
But did you enjoy the twists and turns that it took to get there? And, you know, there's also, you know, diverse casting. There is sort of messing with the idea of Christmas and the elves and what their function is in the Christmas lore, etc. We've got loads of famous people in this. I mean, it's chock-a-block with thesps. Did it do it for you?
I sort of liked it okay enough without ever sort of loving it. But, I mean, I always think good new Christmas films are sort of few and far between. And this was certainly, I think, just like a cut above the average new Christmas film. You know, it was entertaining enough while it was on. And I feel like there was enough there that I would actually revisit it in a future year. I wouldn't kind of, you know, be against giving it another go in future, seeing if it kind of grows into one of those films, you know, that does deserve to be kind of shown again and again. There was something like about it. I thought, you know, the lead child actor, Henry Lawful, who played Nicholas, I thought he was very likable. And like you say, yeah, there's this sort of, it almost has a sort of Harry Potter vibe, like you say, with all the kind of British acting talent that's in it, such as, like, you know, Jim Broadbent, Maggie Smith, Toby Jones, Sally Hawkins is in it as well. So it's sort of a lot of fun in that way. But I can't say I was ever like completely swept up by the story. You know, like it's one of those, it's sort of an origin story of sorts, and you get all these predictable, like, you know, you just know each new revelation that unfolds, that, oh, that's how they get this thing, that's how this thing occurred. It's also, I felt like it there was perhaps it leaned too much on the parental death side of things as well. I haven't read the book, but
yeah, there's a lot of that.
There's a lot of that. So sort of bear that in mind as well, if that's a sort of, you know, potentially going to be a trigger for you or anything. But yeah, I enjoyed it enough. I really like Stephen Merchant, but I felt like he was too much as the mouse. His voice is just so Stephen Merchant-y that it just distracted me too much. I didn't buy it as a mouse. It just felt like Stephen Merchant was doing like funny narration almost, because, you know, the voice just didn't fit at all with the mouse for me. But
can I just put in, I haven't seen this movie, but it sounds absolutely nuts. Like, what's going on? It's like a Santa origin story, but with every famous English actor in, and yes, a talking mouse.
You
and
got Kristen it. Kristen Wiig's in it as well.
Yeah, like, doing an English accent. Yeah. Doing an English accent perfectly, I might add. Yeah,
she's in it for about 5 minutes as well.
She does something dastardly with a turnip, and I don't know. It is. I see what you're saying, Matt, about this. It's got everything that you would want from a Christmas movie. It's high production values, great costumes, wonderful CGI, you know, amazing sort of cast, this Christmassy story. It's got all of these sort of emotional beats, but it's weirdly unmoving. I didn't find myself moved at all. And this is the sort of film that I would generally expect to have a tear in my eye and sort of a little sniffle at the end of. And I just felt completely unmoved. And I don't quite know what it was about that made it feel removed from that sort of emotional core that they were trying to get to.
I felt the same. And there was a sort of, it shared some similar terrain to Mary Poppins Returns in a way, whereas I was just sort of wibbly anytime Ben Whishaw was on screen. I was just much more unmoved by this one, but there was enough there that I feel like it would warrant a future rewatch. And like you say, it's kind of great production values and everything like that, you know. So it's, yeah, I kind of admired that it was doing something a little bit different to your normal Christmas film, but maybe a bit too weird for me.
Are you going to watch it, Jack, with a little cup of eggnog and your Santa slippers on?
There's a really good Christmas movies channel that starts up every year. I say good. It's like it plays like all the like crap Hallmark movies where it's stuff like, you know, oh, marrying Santa Claus and all that.
A Kitten for Christmas and various others. So I like those.
I may wait until it's on there and then give it a watch. So, yeah, I'm not going to be rushing to the cinema, I don't think, to see this one. Maybe. We'll see how Christmassy I feel. And we'll see if they're doing a rerun of Muppet's Christmas Carol, because that would probably be my choice.
Okay. So A Boy Called Christmas is out in cinemas this Friday, and it's also on Sky Cinema. So, you know, you don't have to go to the cinema. You can watch it at home. No, nope, still not sold. He's mildly tempted. Okay, so there you go. There's your review. Somebody on our podcast is mildly tempted. Shall we continue then? Because we've got a lot more to get through. Yes. And the party time does continue with this.
It's called the Dice Code Crew.
Yeah. We're on pirate radio now. Whoa, we've blown up.
Can't believe you're not pirates now. What are you doing later?
Meet me tonight, and that gets us all sick.
Hey, how? You got no money, no guns, nowhere to go.
It's the biggest New Year's Eve ever.
Getting into that party is the only thing that matters.
Boys, we're going on a mission.
So this is Pirates, a film by Reggie Yates. Jack, who are the pirates that we're following?
So Pirates takes place on New Year's Eve 1999, you know, Millennium, New Year's, the big day. I'm sure we're all just old enough to remember.
Yeah.
And so it's a young man called Capo heading back to London from university in his tiny Peugeot 205, wants to hang out with his mates Tyrese and a guy called Kid. And so these three, they form the Ice Cold Crew.
Yeah.
And their big plan for the evening is to spend it inside playing FIFA and watching porn. But Tyrese bumps into an old flame called Sophie, and they decide that no, they're going to have a big Millennium Pie And there's a night going on, and they need to get tickets. They need to get 4 tickets. And so it's basically about their adventures on that night, trying to get the tickets. You know, they are listening to garage music the whole time. They fall out, they steal clothes, they do all sorts. And yeah, it's all directed by Reggie Yates. It's got a very big sense of earnestness to it, I'd say. It's got a real sense of place as well, thanks to like the music and being set in like London and all that. I thought it was quite fun. I mean, I wasn't blown away by it, but I did quite enjoy it. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I was quite charmed by it, actually. Like right from the beginning, like you just get this weird, like out of context sequence of the guys just dancing to. I can't remember what that track's even called, with that womp womp womp. And I was just kind of charmed from then, and just sort of enjoyed spending time with them. It is very slight. I did think it was a very sort of slight film, that there's very, very low stakes. I think it was sort of self-billed as the world's shortest road movie. They don't travel very far, and you know, there's never any kind of real extreme peril. They just kind of almost plod from one bit to the next. But that said, I did enjoy spending time with them, and I thought it was funny and charming, and and just kind of, you know, like that fun little sort of throwback to that sort of UK garage scene and the music of that time, and a few fun little turn of the century jokes as well.
Yeah, you know, about Google.
Yeah, exactly. And nice to see, you know, them in an old little like Peugeot as well, you know.
Yeah, with a University of Hull car sticker, which I liked because I went to the University of Hull myself. So I bonded with them from that moment on. I thought this was very charming. I think charming is the word. It's sweet. It's a bit bawdy. It's not too much. It sort of reminded me of The Inbetweeners. It felt very much like a sort of small screen foray rather than a cinematic one. I think if I'd watched this on TV, I would have probably thought it was amazing. I'm not sure I'd pay to see it at the cinema, but you know, I did find it funny and heartwarming and relatable. I loved the woman who was sold out of everything when they tried to go and get some dinner and was just like, that's not how you say plantain, do you say mountain? Yeah, I loved all those little jokes and the sort of the community spirit of it, and the fact that there's all these guys like in the warehouse being idiotic and like shrink wrapping the trainee, all of that sort of stuff. I felt I understood who these people were. So yeah, I thought it was very sweet and a very promising debut for Reggie Yates, who obviously is better known as a Radio 1 DJ.
Yeah, very promising for a debut. I just like the way it was just very good natured really as well, like overall. Like there was, you know, they obviously had some run-ins and, you know, things like that, but it was just overall, they were just nice guys, I thought. You know, they were just like, they weren't horrible to each other, you know, they weren't horrible to other people. They weren't, it was just nice.
Yes, yeah. And it shares a cast member with House of Gucci, right, Jack?
It does. Youssef Kerber, he has a very big beard in this one, a great big bushy beard. He sells like knockoff clothes and that here, but he's one of the businessmen in House of Gucci. So there you go, there's the line between those two movies you didn't see coming.
There you go.
I quite like the idea of, like, you know, knockoff clothes and also like having Tamagotchis in this one and stuff. Yeah. it was a lot of throwbacks. I mean, some of the stuff like talking about Google, or there was a bit where they kind of talk about maps. There's like a joke about, she should put a map and make it virtual and like on a device or something. Some of that I found a bit too knowing.
Yeah.
Like distractingly so. But I thought overall the effect was, I'll repeat what both you said because it was charming. You know, it's under an hour and a half, so it doesn't outstay its welcome at all. It does feel very, you know, contained. It's funny that they've called it a road trip because nearly all of, you know, there are a lot of scenes in this tiny little car. You know, it definitely took me back to being 18 and spending a lot of time in my mate's car going from place to place. London would have way more traffic though than in this movie. I did kind of like lose track of where we were in London, but that's probably just because I live here. So but apart from that, yeah.
But traffic aside, we're probably saying that it's a recommendation for a warm, cozy. Actually, I felt more warm and cozy about this than I did about the Christmas movie. So this was probably doing more for me than that one.
Yeah, maybe save it for New Year, though. I mean,
it is a New Year film.
You could rewatch this on you know, New Year's in the future, couldn't you? So more rewatchable than the Christmas one by the sounds of it.
Okay, so that is Pirates, and it is available in cinemas from Friday. Right, so from 1999 to 1555, it's time for this.
down in yonder green field. Down, down, hey, down, hey, down.
The boat will be coming in the beginning of the month. Camp down on the beach. These marshes are ours.
There lies a knight slain under his shield with a down.
You stay away from us, do you hear?
His hands, they lie down at his feet.
I am pleased to meet you.
So well they can their master.
Okay, so this is Lapwing, another debut from a writer and director. Jack, what is Lapwing about?
It takes place in 1555, which is a year after the Egyptian Act made it illegal for anyone to harbour Romani or Gypsy people from Egypt. And so the film takes place on a remote Lincolnshire coast. There's a family of religious salt farmers who are led by this kind of bullying, brutish leader played by Emmett J. Scanlon, who was in Peaky Blinders. And they promise to help these two Egyptians get home. I mean, they give unfair terms, but they let the Egyptians kind of stay nearby. And so the film mainly follows this mute English girl who kind of falls in love with this Egyptian boy who's staying near them. And things don't go well from there. There's, you know, a lot of sexist, racist attitudes going on, all kind of upheld by a belief in a higher power. I mean, the cinematography I thought was the standout here. I thought it looked fantastic. I mean, it was quite a difficult watch in many places for me. What did you think, Jane?
Yeah, I mean, even though it's set in 16th century, there's a lot of pertinent stuff here, isn't there? It felt sort of quite Brexity. It felt, you know, it talks about toxic masculinity, sexism, you know, the role of women, you know, xenophobia, all sorts of things going on here that feel very current. And it sort of has that sort of quite modern touch, doesn't it? It sort of reminded me of something like that Andrea Arnold might make. People don't talk in sort of ye olde worldy ways. They talk in a quite modern fashion, but within the constraints of this period film. And yeah, it's another one that felt a bit slight to me, but I think it shows great, great promise. And it's, in a way, it sort of reminded me of Lady Macbeth as well, the sort of idea of following this woman who has no real cachet in this society and what happens when things are taken in a different turn. What happens? How does she assume power? Does she assume power? And how violent and frightening that can be. So yeah, it's a first time screenwriter and a first time director. And I think it's really pretty impressive.
Yeah. I thought the main actress in it, Hannah Douglas, you know, she's got basically no dialogue. You know, she conveys a lot of emotion through her face, and it's very well done. It's very impressive. I didn't find it the most gripping movie throughout. I wasn't tied to every scene necessarily, but I did think it did a very good job of just laying out everything that it wanted to say and building up to an interesting place in the end as well.
And very good at sort of creating a mood, like the music and, as you say, the cinematography and the sort of tone of the film. Is very specific and assured, really, isn't it? They really knew what they were trying to do, and you could sense that they were very, very aware of what they were trying to do, and they delivered that.
Yeah, very different to every other film we've spoken about.
Yes.
That's like
no baubles. Yeah.
No baubles, no massive accents or anything like that. I mean, this again is under an hour and a half, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't outstay its welcome either. And I quite like that, you know, from these debut directors kind of keeping it taut and just doing what is necessary, especially when you consider, like, you know, a lot of big blockbusters at the moment seem to go on for hours. So how do you feel about going to the cinema to see this one? I think maybe to just see the spectacle of, you know, that, I mean, the coastlines are shot so well.
Beautiful.
It was a really, really beautiful movie in that regard. So I think it's definitely one that's worth catching.
Yeah. So it'd be very interesting to see what the writer Laura Turner and the director Philip Stevens do next, because I think as a calling card, this is extremely strong. You know, give them a bit more money. Let's see what they could do. Possibly, I don't know if this is true, but perhaps these debuts are short because there's a lack of funds to do anything really massive. And, you know, Ridley Scott has plenty of money to do 2 hours and 40 minutes of location, location, location. And perhaps that's a virtue for both these films, for Pirates and Lapwing, that necessity is the mother of invention here. And they're both really quite specific and assured in their own way.
It's interesting that both of them are kind of period pieces, especially Lapwing, that, you know, I didn't find that, you know, often with these things, you find that the costumes and stuff just don't look particularly believable when they try and cram in too much stuff, like, you know, they'll have like knights or whatever or things like that. But this keeps it very low key and through the setting, you know, it doesn't have to have too many references to the period itself other than, you know, costumes and the tents that they're staying in and stuff like that. So it does a very good job of creating a sense of place again and time as well, despite not necessarily having to have like the big budget to do that. So it was very cleverly done.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to stay in one of those tents. Didn't feel like there was much protection from the elements at all, but there we go. That's probably the point. So that is Lapwing, and that is out in cinemas from Friday. Right, our final film of the week. A lot to get through, guys. Shall we finish then with this? It's a return to Oliver Stone's opus.
In the years since the Warren Report, there is now so much more that we know. Conspiracy theories are now conspiracy facts.
The Warren Commission successfully deceived the public.
Alan Dulles' appointment to the Warren Commission is one of the great frauds of American history.
Documents are withheld by the FBI, the CIA.
Intelligence agencies did all the wrong things if they were looking for conspiracy.
We will go back and piece together new facts and evidence that shed more light on what really happened here that day.
So this is JFK Revisited, through the looking glass. And what is going on here? I mean, it's Oliver Stone. Jack, what's he doing this time? Obviously, he was hugely influential with the whole JFK conspiracy theories when he brought JFK out starring Kevin Costner, which was a narrative version of events. What's this one?
So this is a documentary, and Oliver Stone very much puts himself into the story this time. You know, he narrates. He's also, we see him wandering around Dallas.
Yes, get it right.
We see him wandering around Dallas in it. But the doc very much takes us into the specifics of very certain things in the JFK assassination. So we look a lot, very in deep at like the magic bullet. We look at Kennedy's biopsy. We even talk about like who took the photographs of what. We go in deeper on the Warren Report. There's also, you know, you obviously have Lee Harvey Oswald and, you know, even some scenes from Stone's JFK movie inserted into this, because that film revitalized this case and did a lot to kind of draw attention to it. It led to documents being declassified sooner than they were going to be. And so the documentary kind of moves on that idea. It also draws a line between the assassination and the fake news agenda of today, saying that, like, you know, the whole conspiracies around it and the idea of not trusting the government is very much carried over to today. He says at one point that, you know, conspiracy theories have turned into conspiracy facts. But I've also done, you know, some reading on this since watching the doc. And there are lots of people who also do still see these as conspiracy theories and see that Stone has told a very kind of one-sided argument. You know, it kind of leans into at the end, kind of putting blame on the CIA and all these powers that be. I'm just not aware enough of the overall conversation and the research that's been done to like form an opinion either way. I don't know if you are, Jane. I mean, the documentary itself is very well told. I mean, I thought the beginning was particularly good. Sometimes it goes into a bit more detail than I thought was like I ever needed to know about a making of a bullet or how photographs taken and stuff like that. But it's just such a big case and such a monumental piece of American history that I can understand why they need to go into that sort of detail.
JFK, when it came out, was like, blew me away. I can remember watching it. I bought it on the VHS. I was really into it. And I became quite obsessed with the Kennedy assassination and the theories that were presented in that film. And so much so that I actually went to Dallas and stood in Dealey Plaza and stood on the grassy knoll and stood where Sapruder stood. And I went into the book depository and I stood at the window and I did the whole shebang because I wanted to see for myself. So I actually do have an opinion on this based on everything I've read and having stood there and stood on the underpass and looked at the triangulation of Crossfire and all of the things that he talks about in that film. And then to watch this film, I found really interesting because it felt a bit of an echo chamber to me. It didn't feel like Oliver Stone was interested in, looking at this from a 360 point of view. All of the experts are people who've written books about specific conspiracies. There's a man who has only written a book about how long it took Lee Harvey Oswald to get from the book depository seventh floor down to the ground, and was that possible? There's another person who is just obsessed with the fact that, you know, the autopsy wasn't undertaken by somebody who specializes in bullet wounds. It was undertaken by somebody at Bathsheba. And so it really is brilliant at showing you what a mess this is. But I feel like right now, at this stage of the game, there's so much time has passed, so much cover-up has happened. And I don't mean that covering up as conspiracy, but just that I think people were possibly covering their asses. I don't think there's any way to get to the truth. And he sets it up with, we're going to get to the truth of what happened. There's no way to get to the truth on this story, I don't think. And therefore, the fun, if there is fun in, you know, picking apart a man's death and the destruction of a family, is in picking apart these things. And, you know, it's that Occam's razor thing, isn't it? Sometimes the most obvious answer is the right one, but equally, you know, a stopped clock tells the right time twice a day. Coincidence, conspiracy, all of this feeds into it. So from that point of view, I can only watch it as a sort of entertainment, not necessarily as a factual documentary, because I don't think he's removed enough from the subject matter to be able to do that. Sorry, well, that was quite a long answer to your answer of whether I knew much about it. But yeah, so I found it fascinating, but not necessarily the truth.
Is there anything kind of revelatory within the documentary then? Because it is presented in like, oh, we're going to put some new information out there. Like, I mean, as I say, I'm not really involved with it. So like, did you learn anything from it, or were you just kind of like, not sure?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, since JFK, as you say, at the end of JFK, you get this note card that says, you know, the files will open in 50 years' time. And we're like, God, I'm going to be so old by the time I see any of those documents. And as you say, the files have been open since then. So that sort of information that he's got to hand is new. I think the most interesting part and the most part that actually made me think, that's something I haven't really heard before, is this idea of other patsies in other cities that were groomed by dark factions of the government to be a Lee Harvey Oswald on any of the sort of stops that JFK might have made. And that, you know, that people were employed and put in offices that were high on parade routes that JFK might have taken. That's quite interesting. But again, he doesn't interview anybody from the CIA. He doesn't interview anyone involved with the Warren Report. I mean, I realize that a lot of people will be dead by now, but he doesn't interview anyone official. So you don't get any other argument to this. You just get a load of conspiracy theorists going, oh, you know, like, look at this facts that, you know, like the bullet was found on a stretcher at this time, but then it was admitted into evidence at this time, but then somebody else admitted it into evidence at this time. So that proves that can't be right. But actually, when you think about it, what we're dealing with here is an event that took place in 1963. It was unprecedented. There was no computers. There was no formal methodology to deal with this. Maybe it's just that it was just a F show, you know, and people were just not documenting stuff correctly because the president had been killed and this hadn't happened for decades. So maybe that's the answer, but nobody in the documentary says that. So yeah, it is fascinating and I loved it. I was, as the nerd in me, was thrilled by all of the stuff that was put in here, and the autopsy diagrams and the pictures, and also, you know, the fact that the Warren Report does have some dodgy folk on the Warren Report. The Warren Commission is, you know, with people who shouldn't have been involved from the CIA because they couldn't be at all removed from that discussion. But that's not necessarily what Stone is trying to say, doesn't necessarily prove what Stone is trying to say. So I think it's more of a nice thing to watch if you're interested in this, and it gives you more to think about and more to investigate, but it certainly doesn't give you any final answers. Matt, does it float your boat?
In honesty, not wildly. I was going to actually ask
Were you, are you nodding off whilst I bag on about Zapruder?
No, I was going to ask you, because you're obviously a JFK geek, but I haven't seen the film for a long time, and I'm not a particular like American history buff or anything like that. Would I enjoy this film? Is it purely for the hardcore, or is it quite accessible if, you know, you're just coming to it without much background knowledge?
I mean, I really like JFK, the movie, and I think that there were lots of interesting things in here, but then a lot of me was like, why are we spending 20 minutes talking about why a bullet went from one person to another, and that it wasn't quite, you know, written down properly? I can understand why, but at the same time, it just feels like there are much bigger things to be talking about in the context of this, because I'm such a like new person to it. There was almost like more just general background and explanation that I wanted, rather than, you know, we're going to talk about this, you know, how
the magic bullet theory.
Yeah, I kind of got it pretty quickly that, you know, it probably couldn't happen like they said it would, and therefore, you know, putting doubt in your mind about it. And then they kind of kept going into more details, and I was a bit like, well, I kind of get it now. But at the same time, you know, it's such a big event that if you're going to present stuff as seemingly evidence, I guess you need to go into that amount of detail. Perhaps for me, I just needed a documentary that was a bit broader. You know, the bits I found interesting were stuff like drawing a line between that and what's going on today in America and the reaction to the government. That was what I found interesting. And I was like, oh, I could watch someone talking more about that, and actually maybe kind of going into other events that have happened since that have kept that momentum going in America of distrust in, you know, media and government. And maybe that's the documentary
that sounds really interesting, to use JFK as a sort of posit that, you know, this is where people stopped trusting what is presented as fact, because it's universally one of those events that people do think didn't happen the way it's been presented by the Warren Commission. So yeah, I think that would be a really interesting documentary, but it's not the one that he's made.
No, it's not. I mean, that's only kind of like a sidebar on, you know, what's happened. So yeah, I'm not sure if I would recommend it to like anyone else like me, who's just kind of, you know, generally interested in it and wants to understand that bit of American history more. You know, I also think it does make a few assumptions that you are already invested slightly in the story, because it starts at points just throwing out names and people who are involved. And I was just like, wow, I need to take a step back and do some Googling.
Yeah, I think it totally is a companion piece, isn't it, to JFK? You're supposed to watch JFK and understand, you know, all of the theories that are posited within that film, backwards and to the left, backwards and to the left and all of that. And then watch this film, which is sort of like the update to those theories. Matt, going to watch it? Well, mildly tempted.
Yeah, mildly tempted. But the thing is, the problem with this is I need to find time to watch JFK again first, which is obviously the big roadblock. So when the time allows for that, maybe over the Christmas holes, maybe.
Cool.
I don't know, back to back, it's like 5 hours with this. So
yeah. And you're going to see a lot of a president's head exploding within that time.
There's some really vivid imagery that they show, like some of the photos. It's quite hard to watch.
Okay. So that's not very Christmassy, but that is JFK Revisited Through the Looking Glass, and it's out in cinemas on Friday. That's it from this week. What is your film of the week, chaps? What are you saying is the one to go and see this week?
I would say House of Gucci, definitely. I think it's just real fun. I think it's exactly the sort of movie that people will go into and just have a laugh and not take too seriously and feel like it was money well spent.
It's joint for me between House of Gucci and Encanto. I think Encanto is the better film overall, but both are a lot of fun. Both, I imagine, we'll get a lot of rewatches over the years. So yeah, both safe bets there.
Yeah, it's House of Gucci for me all the way. I think I might go and see it again this weekend. Okay, so before we go, it's time for a reader's question. And this ties into Jack's recent chat with Ridley Scott. Who's your favourite director to interview? Matt?
This is such a tough question. I don't really know how to answer this one because, of course, I'd be tempted to give my boring, obvious answer and say Christopher Nolan, because, of course, that's always exciting and he's always ridiculously eloquent and, you know, you're generally talking about a really exciting film. But then there's loads of just interesting like that. And some people surprise you, like David Fincher, who I did last year. I was really nervous before that because he has such a fearsome sort of reputation. But then he was another who just kind of cool direct, was very sort of self-deprecating, very sort of accommodating, just stayed on the phone like much, much longer than he should have done. And even then at the end, he was like, oh, you know, you sure you've got enough? You know, and I've sort of been on the phone for like 90 minutes or something. It's always enjoyable with someone like William Friedkin, for example, as well, who are just so kind of candid and don't hold anything back. You know, that's always a fun kind of interview to do. But yeah, so there's too many for me to narrow it down, really.
Jack, how did Ridley scale on your director's chats?
Oh, it's definitely one of the most fun. I wish I'd had much, much more time, which I think is always the sign that you've, you know, spoken to someone who, you know, is good. I like the, you know, candidness of it all. I mean, I'm jealous listening to Matt and everyone he's spoken to, because I'd love to talk to Nolan and Fincher and all that, everyone like that. But some of my favorite interviews, I mean, like Matt meeting Nolan, I interviewed Peter Jackson, and that was
did you manage
really
not
cool.
to cry and shake and sort of fall?
I kept it very cool, thank you. But he, again, you know, we kind of like ran out of time. It was like half an hour or so, and then he was going into another interview, but we just ended up outside the room having a little chat, because it was just after his World War One documentary came out, and we were just having a good little chinwag outside about that. And he was just very, very accommodating and very nice. Another
when
person,
you say accommodating, was that because you had like tied him up and put him in a cell?
Yeah, you I just cornered him and was like, oh my God.
Did he have fear in his eyes?
Yeah. No, he was really nice, and I kept it cool. And I think another one, when I did the Star Wars stuff for the mag, and there was J.J. Abrams, I've interviewed him two or three times now. And, you know, if he doesn't want to talk about something, because he's always got so many projects on, he's always quite nice and cool about it. But also, he's just so enthusiastic about everything he's working on. And I've got a lot of time for that. You know, coming out of Rise of Skywalker interviews with him, you know, I was absolutely buzzing for that film. And I don't always get that, but there was a general sense of like, this sounds like he really, you know, there's just so much excitement for it. And everyone enjoyed working with him so much. You know, I mean, this gets a slight shame about the movie. Not everyone's the biggest fan. I prefer it to most, I think.
Jack has sort of inspired me there to remember one interview I did a while back for the Tom Cruise film, The Mummy. And I interviewed Alex Kurtzman, who directed that, for a preview piece. And he honestly made it sound like the best film ever. I genuinely came away from the interview.
I know, but they have to sell their vision to the studios. So they're very skilled at this. Yeah. And so when they tell you about a film, you're like, this is going to be amazing. Yeah.
He genuinely made it sound amazing. And another one I just remembered thinking of, the fact that I know the sequel is obviously on the horizon, but Garth Jennings, who directed Sing, is just like, was one of those people, he's just so ridiculously nice, and like he just kind of like emanates niceness, and you feel like you're just sort of, you know, like marinating in sort of pleasantness just talking to him, because just he just comes across as just so warm and sort of kind and everything. And Rian Johnson kind of has that as well, I find, because I interviewed him for The Last Jedi. And obviously, I mean, the amount of kind of stress you must be under doing something like that, you know, finishing the final stages of that kind of film. But he just kind of, again, just made you feel like you had just like, you know, you had all the time in the world almost to talk, and that, you know, made you really feel like it was kind of worthwhile, and that you kind of appreciated it and everything like that, you know, which is, again, that can be rare sometimes, you know. So he's another kind of lovely one to talk to.
Yes, I would like to say Greta Gerwig is everything you'd hope she'd be. And I love that she talks just exactly like the characters that she plays. And it's just a delight to hear that in real life. Also, Spielberg. There's no greater thrill for me as a kid who grew up with E.T. and Jaws to actually walk into a room and meet the beard. And he does have that amazing aura. He is a proper star director, isn't he? And everybody knows who Spielberg is. If I tell my mum I'm going to be interviewing XYZ, often she'd be like, never heard of him. But the week I said it's Spielberg on the back lot in LA, she was like, oh my God, what's he like? What's he like? And he was carrying an unlit cigar. He had like the glasses on, the cap. He was wearing just a sort of, you know, an Indiana Jones outfit. Absolutely delightful. Had time to talk about everything. I get goosebumps. He was amazing. So yeah, the Spielberg, the beard, a cracker.
Very generous.
I've stunned you to silence there, haven't I?
I think that's like every film journalist's dream, isn't it? To go meet Spielberg on an LA lot somewhere. It's like,
It was a good day. Okay, so on that note, we hope you all have a good day wherever you are, but it's now time to say goodbye. And I think you should do it in the style of a character from House of Gucci. Say goodbye, Jack.
Arrivederci.
Matt, say goodbye.
Goodbye. Yeah.
And it's arrivederci from me too. We will see you next week.
Mi scusi.